Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday morning. Scott Hellman is our guest this hour, author of an absolutely fascinating and extremely complete biography of Mitt Romney. The book is The Real Romney. Scott is a staff writer at the Boston Globe, where he's been a reporter and editor for more than 10 years. He served as a lead writer on the 2008 presidential campaign and has been the paper's political editor. And it's always amazing how many people we find who have Wisconsin connections. He did go to college at UW-Madison, so another fellow Badger. The book, the Washington Post review of this book, says that for any biographer, Romney presents, to put it gently, a high degree of difficulty. Not only is he deeply cautious, but the two institutions that have perhaps been the most important to his life and career, the Mormon Church and the private equity firm Bain Capital, are heavily fortified and stonily non-transparent. The authors, however, do a fine job of looking at the history of the Romney family in the Mormon faith, and also looking at the private equity firm Bain Capital and how Mitt Romney made a lot of money. It looks at a lot of other issues as well: his missionary work, his romance with Ann Romney, which started when they were both extremely young, his time at Stanford University, his time at Harvard, the Mormon faith, the importance of his family, his children, all of that covered in this book, plus the earlier presidential run and what's going on with the candidate right now. So we'll be welcoming phone calls from you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and you can always send us a message on our Facebook page, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Scott, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. Good to be here.
Yeah, the book is absolutely fascinating.
Thank you.
So he was a miracle baby, huh?
Right. So George and Lenore Romney, Mitt Romney's parents, have three kids, and the doctors had basically told her no more. She could not get pregnant again. Her body wouldn't take it. It would be unsafe. Well, they learned they were pregnant again, and they were nervous about this, of course, because of what the doctors had said. And despite all the odds, Mitt Romney, the youngest of four, was born healthy. And it's funny, sort of from that moment on, he seems to have occupied a kind of special place in his parents' hearts, I think in part because he was a baby that was never supposed to be.
Right. I found the Mormon history absolutely fascinating. We don't know a whole lot about this, and he leaves parts of the biography out of the picture, but you have to tell part of this story, starting with the first person who came to this country and why Mormonism was so attractive.
Right. So Mitt Romney's, he had a relative that was in England at the time, and this was in the 19th century, and he hears a Mormon missionary talking about this new faith, this young faith, and how this was sort of the real faith, if you will, and this was the answer. It was a very appealing pitch, and so this ancestor of Mitt Romney's decides to come to America to check it out, and lo and behold, the Romneys become really one of the founding families of Mormonism, and they are right there in the 1800s as this faith is gaining new adherents and of course also attracting persecution in large part because of their steadfast belief at the time in polygamy. So, you know, you have, it's funny, you think about Mitt Romney today and we see him as this, you know, really successful businessman with nice cars and manicured lawns and many houses and everything, but you don't have to go back that far into his family to find, you know, these other Romney men who were living very difficult lives. They were kicked out of town after town as the Mormons were being persecuted and driven from Illinois and then Utah and eventually driven out of this country. Mitt Romney's father, George, was actually born on a Mormon colony in Mexico and didn't come to the States until he was five. So, you know, if you think about George Romney, who some of your listeners may remember as the three-term governor of Michigan, he's sort of the link between those pioneer days, the kind of rough and tumble life of the early Romneys and the Mitt Romney that we know today.
Mm-hmm. His father's story is equally as interesting as Mitt Romney's, if not more so, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, you have somebody who, here's somebody who, you know, again, was born in Mexico, came to the States not much money, worked himself up sort of through sheer will to be an auto, really a top auto executive in Detroit. This was somebody who didn't graduate from college. And then he parlays that into a very successful political career. And, you know, George Romney at the time really represented, he was one of the leading figures of the kind of moderate wing of the Republican Party. And he was revered in many quarters, not just among Republicans, for his, you know, his sort of blunt style and his willingness to talk about things that other Republicans weren't talking about. I mean, this was somebody who stormed out of the 64 Republican convention because of what the Republican Party was saying about civil rights or not saying about civil rights.
Right.
So he's a fascinating man in his own right, and in many ways very different than his son.
Yes. Just one final thought on those early days of his ancestors. It was interesting. It's hard to understand Mormonism. Two questions here, really. Has Mitt Romney ever talked about his great-grandfather? And secondly, how difficult it was. Where did you get the information about his great-grandmother, who had to welcome the other wives into the home and spent quite a bit of time crying about all of that?
Right. So on the first question, I mean, I think he's had, as Mitt Romney's been in political life, he has not been terribly comfortable telling the story, or kind of not comfortable understanding kind of in his own mind how much he wants to give away, you know, how much he wants to talk about it publicly. And, you know, I think at the same, he's very proud of the heritage, and he talks about being a member of this, you know, this family that really helped establish Mormonism in the world, and how proud he is of that and how important his faith is. And if you, in his old home in Belmont, you know, he had these framed pictures of his ancestors in a very prominent place in the house. But as a political issue, of course, it's dicey because, as you know, there are a lot of people out there who are skeptical of Mormonism, who don't understand it. Some of them, particularly evangelicals, believe it's not really Christian. And so this has been a matter of sensitivity for him. And look, I think he's still contending with that today. We just saw over the weekend, he and his campaign decided to let some reporters in to watch him, to go to church with him.
Mm-hmm.
And that has never happened before. And to me, that reflects a shift in thinking on their part, that they have to open up about this part of his life.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of getting all this material about the ancestors, I should say that, you know, this is very much a Boston Globe project. I mean, the book grows out of really 20 years of Globe reporting on Mitt Romney as a businessman, as a political leader. And so we had the benefit a few years ago of, you know, a lot of wonderful reporters and editors here working on this stuff. And so we had sent, you know, people to Utah to look in the archives and get primary source documents, and to Mexico, to France, where he did mission, to mission. I mean, really everywhere that was important to his life, we sent people and tried to understand where he came from. So, you know, this is a book that would have been impossible for just Michael and I, my co-author and I, to have done ourselves. It's really a group project.
Yes. Let's talk about Anne for a moment, who he met and fell in love with pretty much immediately when they were both very young, and he never gave up on her, did he?
No, this is really the first priority in Mitt Romney's life from a pretty young age, was to keep Anne, to not let her out of his sight. They had, I think, known each other briefly in elementary school when they were very young, but then they met again when they were in high school. Mitt Romney was a few years older, and they had both gone to these local prep schools. And you're right. I mean, Mitt Romney describes looking over at Anne, seeing her at some event, and deciding, you get the sense that he decided right then and there, you know, this is the woman I want to marry, you know, which seems kind of impossible and fairy tale-ish. But, I mean, really, he, from that moment on, even when they were in different places, when, you know, when he went off to Stanford for school, or when he was in France for his mission and she was still back in Detroit, you know, he this, like, keep holding on to her was his main goal in life. You know, it's funny, he follows after his dad's example in that way, because his dad George had a similar courtship of Lenore, his mother, and really was really aggressive. And, you know, there's stories of him, you know, pulling her off the dance floor when she was dancing with somebody else. I mean, he's a very single-minded
I love the story of Romney when he's at Stanford. He's flying home to see Anne, and at one point he sells his clothing. This is hard to imagine thinking of him now, to be able to purchase an airplane ticket to come home and see her.
Right. So this was when the year when Mitt Romney went off to Stanford University, his first year of college, and Ann Davies at the time is still back at home, and they didn't want their parents to know that they were doing this. So he would sneak back, and he was selling his coats, and he was working as a security guard and I think a bus driver and all these funny menial jobs, in part to make money for the plane tickets. And they described at one point, I think they had gone to some party and had seen his parents there, and sort of quickly ducked out of the back because they didn't want to be noticed. So George Romney eventually got wind of this and even talked to a friend of one of Mitt's friends at Stanford and said, look, can you keep an eye on him? I'm worried he's not studying, he's not serious, he's chasing his girl, but, give Mitt Romney credit. He knew what was important, he knew what he wanted,
Right. So he left Stanford because you have to do mandatory missionary work. It was interesting to think about the time, and you write about the time at which he left. It was the Vietnam War was creating great controversy. He was picketing the picketers at Stanford, but the war really became hugely problematic for this country and for people his age. We had a series of assassinations, and instead of being in college at that time, he was doing missionary work in France. If he had stayed, I guess you could ask the question, would he have been the same person?
I think that's a very good question, and it's something we have thought a lot about. If you think about Mitt Romney, his life growing up especially, and even now to some extent, is it's a series of bubbles. I mean, he grows up in a very cloistered Mormon community in Detroit. He's at a very elite prep school for high school. He's in this Mormon mission for 2.5 years in France. He comes back from that mission, marries Anne, and sort of right into this life of a dad and a businessman. That year at Stanford is, to me, this interesting break from all that, and it's where he starts to get, I think, a window of the wider world. He's thrown together with all these different people, a lot of people who would end up being prominent anti-war voices, even at Stanford, which was not, which was a fairly buttoned-down place compared with other campuses. But right as that stuff is starting to really, churn, and right as the anti-war movement is starting to heat up, is when he leaves for France. So he has this sort of stunted social development, almost, I think, because once he's away in France, certainly he's interacting with, it's not like he's completely insulated from the war and from the United States, what they were doing and so forth. But, you get the sense that he was apart from all that, and he kind of missed a really important chapter in American history, if you will. Because by the time he came back, it was the early 70s, literally a lot of this was still going on. But by that point, I think he had already kind of made up his mind who he was, who he would be. And in fact, he was very turned off by all of those protests, and I think appalled by, that kind of behavior. And you mentioned protesting the protesters. There's a great photo we have in the book of him in a, suit jacket, with holding a sign that says, speak out, don't sit in.
Mm-hmm.
He is somebody who, as an institutionalist, really did not like or appreciate or approve of the kind of protest impulse.
His father had some problems with Vietnam policy. Did the two of them discuss those differences of opinion that Romney, his father, had?
I think they did. I mean, Romney's father, who ran for president in 1968, he came up short in that campaign, in large part, some would say, because of his candor. He had given an interview in which he had talked about having been brainwashed by the generals in Vietnam, and he had come to be a big critic of the war effort. And the thinking, I think, at the time was, if you can be brainwashed by American generals, how can we trust you to sit across the table from the Soviets or some other world leader? And so Mitt Romney, it's interesting, he was really affected by what had happened to his father and the way that he had had to exit that campaign, and because of his really his blunt style, and I think he took that lesson to heart. You know, you have to be really disciplined and careful what you say. But you know, Mitt Romney later said that he agreed with his father that his father had been right, you know, and that the war had been a mistake, and that was the only real conclusion to have. So you have to keep in mind this is Mitt Romney as a 19, 20, 21 year old, so somebody who is forming his own opinions with maturing quickly. So I think we can allow certainly a little bit of latitude in kind of judging his comments on the war. But you do see him say different things, even about service. I mean, he at one point said he never had any intention of serving in Vietnam. He never would have done it. At a different point, he says he wishes he would have done it. He kind of missed that opportunity. He would have liked to have served. So two different perspectives there.
And he got a 4D because of his missionary work?
Right. So at the time, and this became a source of controversy at the time, because a lot of Mormon men were getting religious deferment because of their missionary work. And Mitt Romney was lucky in a sense, because when they started to limit the number of deferments you could get from any one place. And so if Mitt Romney had been from Utah, where there are a lot more Mormons, he may have had a better chance of actually, you know, being drafted. But since he came from Michigan, where there were comparatively few Mormons, I think it was never in question.
We're going to welcome phone calls for our guest. Scott Hellman is our guest, and he is the author of a very interesting book about Mitt Romney. It is titled The Real Romney, and as you heard him say, it really was a Boston Globe project, too, so they were able to send people all over the world where there are Romney roots. Scott is a staff writer at the Boston Globe. He has worked as a reporter and editor for more than a decade. He was previously the paper's political editor and a national political reporter, serving as a lead writer on the last presidential campaign. Here's our phone number for you to join the conversation, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org for those messages that you'd like to send that way. And you can always leave messages on our Facebook page as well, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The Real Romney, this hour of the program. Our phone number again, 800-486-8655. A couple lines are open. The book is extremely thorough, so pick any part of his life or the lives of the people who were his ancestors, current campaign, all of that is up for discussion this hour. Our first call is Jack in Madison. Hi, Jack.
Hi. Yes, I understand that during his time in France that there was an automobile accident and that the records of this incident disappeared from the police file. And I was wondering if your crew of journalists had tried to locate these records.
Thanks for the call. So when Mitt Romney was nearing the end of his tenure as a missionary, this was June of 1968, he is driving a car that's full of Mormons. They had gone down to visit a congregation in a southern French city called Pau. And they were on their way back to Paris. At this point, Mitt Romney is driving the car. He's driving the Citroen with the French mission president, his wife, and a few other Mormons from the area. And in this little town, they got in a horrible, nearly head-on crash with a Catholic priest. And the impact was so great that the French mission president's wife, a woman named Leola Anderson, was killed. She survived a couple of hours and died. It was a very tragic event, not only, of course, for Mitt and for the family, but really for Mormons everywhere. This was a big deal, even in Salt Lake City at the headquarters. And, by all accounts, Mitt Romney, even though he was the driver, he was not at fault in the accident. And there has been nothing that has surfaced to suggest otherwise, I don't think that, I mean, we did go to France and we did, you know, we talked to people who were in the car. We got what records we could. I don't think there was anything sinister about the records not existing. I think it was just too long ago, and this is 68, and I don't think, you know, the French local French police kept them that long. But, I mean, it was what's clear is it was a very tragic event, and, you know, this is where you hear people talk about people who knew Romney at the time, where he first started to show some of the leadership capacity that he would show later, because the mission president, who's really in charge of all the missionaries across France, it's a pretty big job, he had to go home. He was hurt. He was grieving his wife, and it fell to Mitt and some of the young missionaries to run the place. And Mitt Romney, by all accounts, really stepped up as a young man and, you know, made sure that missionaries were coming and going, make sure the schedule was working, dealt with problems for a few months.
And moving ahead a little bit, there also is a pattern of his stepping up to help people, particularly fellow Mormons whose houses are burning, to save them. He really is front and center in being very generous in that community.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that was really clear when we were reporting this book. I mean, there are many, many people who have stories of how Mitt Romney has helped them in ways large and small. You know, sometimes it was writing a check for something, contributing some money, which, as we know, is not a huge lift for somebody as wealthy as Mitt Romney. But in many cases, it wasn't that. It was lending a hand to, you know, in one example, help build a playground to honor the late son of a close friend and neighbor. In another case, he led a brigade of neighbors rushing into a burning house to save a friend and neighbor's furniture. You know, there are many stories like this of I think him and the family's generosity, and I think that's real. I think it's a part of whatever you think of his politics and his positions and so forth. I think undeniably he has helped a lot of people. And you know, look, this is I think motivated probably both by a personal belief that that service is important, but also this is a big Mormon value. You know, community service, helping others. You know, especially within the Mormon Church, that is something that you are expected to do.
Thank you, Jack, for the call. Jean in Wauwatosa, hi.
Hi, good morning. So given the author's extensive knowledge of Romney, what could he interpret Mitt Romney meaning when he was speaking to the NAACP a couple of weeks ago and he said, if you could see what's in my heart, what are we to take that he meant by that? I mean, obviously politically, but just, oh, it's been bugging me. Wondered if you have any help on that.
Yeah, it's a good, it's an interesting question. I mean, you know, I think my sense of what he was saying there, my guess, is that he's saying, you know, look, I know I'm not going to get many of your votes here, and you may not like some of my politics, but, you know, in my heart, I think I want everybody to have a chance to succeed, and, you know, I'm for opportunity for all. I mean, he does talk about, there was this controversy, big controversy, really, one of the biggest in kind of the modern history of the Mormon Church, because until 1978, they did not allow African Americans to hold the priesthood. And, you know, that's pretty late if you think about it, 1978. This is something that Mitt Romney's father, George, really was advocating to change, and there are letters and so forth that he was writing to Mormon officials saying, you know, this, we have to change this. Mitt Romney describes driving that day in 1978 when he heard that the policy had changed, and he talked about openly weeping that you know, he was so happy that the church had finally made this change. So, you know, maybe what he's saying there is that he you know, encouraging people to believe that he, you know, believes in equality and opportunity for everybody, and not to be, you know, caught up in the rhetoric of the campaign. I mean, that's my best guess. There may be, you know, smarter interpretations of it.
You write, and this is in reference to George Romney, his father. It's hard it's hard to understand this. I know it was a while ago, but it is still hard to understand this. The church policy at the time was that blacks could join as members but not become members of the priesthood. In 1964, a top Mormon official wrote to George Romney, this is, calling a civil rights bill vicious legislation and warning Romney that it was not man's job to remove what he termed the Lord's curse upon the Negro.
Right. I mean, and this was, you know, the language on this stuff in Mormon text is pretty shocking, you know, I think, in a lot of ways. I mean, it talks about black people being the result of, you know, having a curse upon them, and the color of their skin was evidence of that. So you can see why this was such a big deal, not just in Mormon culture, but in the sort of political sphere. And George Romney was somebody who... you know, was very, I think, was very supportive of integration, certainly of integrated housing. He made a lot of waves on that, and he was outspoken in opposing the church's views on this. So I think George gets credit for, you know, for being kind of an outspoken civil rights proponent at a time when it wasn't necessarily popular within the church. But and later, I mean, you know, you think about the Mormon church and how it's grown. A lot of how it's grown is by really growing in ethnic communities. Even in Boston, they started to recruit a lot of Haitians, a lot of Spanish-speaking people, a lot of Cambodians, so forth. So the church has diversified, but I know for a lot of people, the some of that language that you're referencing there and the relatively recent admission of blacks into the priesthood is still a big problem.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, though, because Mitt Romney does have, as you write about, this kind of social awkwardness about him. You would think, given his father's ability to move freely among all kinds of people and champion causes like civil rights, that Mitt Romney might feel a little more comfortable in some of those circles, but he appears not to.
Yeah, you would think. I mean, he doesn't take after his father at all. I think a lot of the similarities between them are somewhat superficial. Mm. I mean, if you think about, they were both governors at age 55. They were both successful in business and then went into politics. They were both local Mormon leaders. They led big, you know, prominent Mormon families. They look very similar if you look at some of the old pictures. Mm-hmm. But, you know, stylistically, they're very, very different. Mitt Romney is much more cautious, much more reserved, much more, tries to be much more disciplined, and he lacks that authenticity, I think, that George Romney just exuded on the campaign trail. I didn't have the benefit of knowing George personally, but by all accounts, you know, he spoke what was on his mind, and sort of whatever happened, happened, you know, and that kind of... almost sort of brash, again, blunt-spoken character is an appealing one in the political world. And you know, Mitt Romney is much more calculating, much more careful. You get the sense that, you know, George Romney would sort of say what it was everyone was on his mind, and that Mitt Romney is deliberating kind of always, you know, what am I going to say here, and what effect will it have on my political future, and should I say it that way or should I not? And you can almost see him getting tripped up when he's on the campaign trail, because it's like he's got this overly strategic mindset, and he's not comfortable just talking, you know, mm-hmm. and just being himself.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because their lives seem to be structured that way, too. You write about Monday night is family night, Tuesday night you play games or you meet with the community, Thursday night, I've got the order all mixed up, you study religious study. It's a very structured life that his family has had.
It's true, and I think within that structure, by all accounts, he's very comfortable. And I think some of the people who object most to the description of him as stiff and aloof and hard to connect to and so forth are people that know him in that family setting and in the Mormon church setting, because those are his natural environments. I think outside of that, he has a much, much tougher time, and he doesn't have the social skills, and I don't think he has the... He doesn't feel the need to. He's not, you know, how some people almost crave that kind of approval or that kind of social interaction.
Yes.
You know, you go up to someone in the office or on the street, and you have a nice conversation about what's going on in your life or how are your kids, or, you know, I heard your dog broke his leg, I hope he's okay,
right.
Or whatever
right.
It is. You know, Mitt Romney has never done that, and there are people who have worked for him for years who will tell you that we have a very surface relationship, you know, that you are there to perform a function and do a job, but He's not real interested in getting, you know, getting deeper than that.
It's interesting you brought up the word dog, because that's a story that has had unbroken legs for a long time, right?
Right. That was maybe an inadvertent Freudian
right.
reference there or something. But, yeah, this is one of the stories that everybody loves. This was unearthed by a colleague of mine. And now, Yeah, it's become sort of shorthand for Mitt Romney. You know, how does Mitt Romney deal with problems? And then everyone knows about Seamus, the Irish setter that they famously put in a car top carrier on a trip to Canada one summer. And I won't, at the risk of sending your listeners fleeing from their radio, I won't describe exactly what the dog was doing that caused the kids to howl in disgust in the back of the station wagon. But shall we say the dog was not terribly happy being on top of the car going 60 miles an hour.
And right.
Mitt Romney, you know, he's got the whole thing planned out, and they don't have time to stop and deal with it, so he pulls over, hoses him down, and gets back on the road.
Right.
That's Mitt Romney.
Yeah. Gene, thanks for the call. John in Eagle River, hi.
Hi, how are you guys?
All right, how are you?
Good.
Good.
A number of questions. George Romney, the father, was born, I think, in Mexico, and yet he ran for president. Was that even possible back then, that he could have been president? The other thing is, two other questions. One about Mitt Romney talking to the veterans of foreign wars a few weeks back in Las Vegas, and he kept on using the term foreigner when he was referring to Obama. Does that make any sense? And I guess the last question is, what do Romney's sons do? Or daughters? I don't know. If he's
They're all
daughters.
Sons. Sure. They're all boys.
Okay, let me try to. I'm going to try to remember all those. So, George, in terms of George running for president, I think there was some debate about this at the time. But, I mean, two things. One, his parents were from here, so I think maybe it didn't matter that he was born in Mexico if his parents were citizens. And then also, I think it's possible this would have been a matter of broader debate if he had actually gotten further. George Romney dropped out of the presidential race pretty early on in the primary process, so it never, I don't think, really got to a point where maybe there was a big national discussion about this and could he run. On the question of the foreigners, I don't recall that in the speech offhand. Certainly this has been an undercurrent that you see on the right about, you know, President Obama being this mysterious, nefarious other, which I think is problematic on a number of levels. I mean, Mitt Romney generally has been pretty careful to steer clear of that kind of rhetoric and that kind of language. So I don't know. I can't tell you exactly what he was referring to there. And then on the sons, he has five sons, and several of them are in either private equity or, you know, real estate management, real estate investment. And then his son Ben is a doctor. I believe he's a radiologist. So he's sort of the one in the family that's gone in a slightly different direction. Mm-hmm. But, and I'm sure you've seen, the sons have been fairly active in his political campaign. They're very active in the last presidential race and then intermittently active in this race as well.
So how wealthy is Mitt Romney?
I mean, he's extremely wealthy. I think the estimates were up to $250 million in assets. It could be a lot. Some people believe it's a lot more than that because he still has investments out there that are making lots of money. Now we know that he has a very, very favorable tax rate. I think he said the other day that he had paid on average a 13% over the last decade or so. I mean, that's, you know, an incredibly low, enviable tax rate because when you have that much money and you're paying that low of a rate, I mean, naturally there are raises questions about whether the tax policy in this country is equitable and should there be changes. And so I think every time we see this discussion about is he going to release his taxes and what does he pay, I think it just reminds people how different he is and how in a different class of wealth he and his family are and whether or not it's fair for that class of people to get these really fantastically low rates.
It is a different way of life, isn't it? When I was reading your book about the homes they have and where they are and the swimming pools and the tennis courts, and it's not just one, it's It's several homes, and it's just a different way of living.
It is, and I think you know, one of the reasons that this has gotten so much attention in the campaign, it's not just that Mitt Romney has been successful. I think, you know, we've long had politicians who have been very wealthy, and I don't think anybody, or most voters, I think it's fair to say, don't begrudge somebody for being successful and making money. We all aspire to that. That's in some ways the message of the country. But, you know, in his case, he has shown such an inability, I think, to relate to people who aren't like that. And, I mean, you remember this a few months ago. I mean, it was like every week would go by, he would say something else about how, oh, you know, the $300,000, $400,000 he made in speaking fees 1 year. Well, that wasn't really a lot of money. Or,
right.
You know, he bets Rick Perry $10,000 in a casual bet during a debate. And there are just things that, like this, and that they aren't just gaffes, right? I mean, gaffes, all politicians make gaffes. Gaffes, most of the time, I think, don't really matter. But for Romney, they do, because they often connect to this central problem, political problem, which is, does he even understand what it's like to go from paycheck to paycheck, or be at risk of losing a job, you know? And this is where I think these aren't just misstatements that that we can easily wave away. I think there's a real question. Does he really understand, you know, what it's like to not be as comfortable as Mitt Romney is, you know? And it's something voters are going to weigh very carefully.
We'll spend some time talking about the private equity firm Bain Capital, where he made a lot of money, and how easy or difficult it was to get records about all of that. Our guest this hour is co-author of The Real Romney. Scott Hellman is our guest. It's out in paperback, and it's a very extensive look at the entirety of Mitt Romney's life and his ancestors' lives as well. Lots of information about his father and his grandfather and his great-grandfather. Scott is a staff writer at the Boston Globe, and he is... he has Wisconsin ties because he went to UW-Madison. He was lead writer on the 2008 presidential campaign. Phone calls, 800-486-8655. John, thanks for your call. A couple lines are open right now. You can also go to our email, talk@WPR.org, or Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to another phone call, and then we'll talk about Bain Capital for a little while. Marcia in Madison, hi.
Hi. My grandmother, for my family, started off in England, too, as early converts to the church and came to the United States, went through Kirkland, Nauvoo, and ended up being on the Pioneer Trail and in Utah. My grandmother was born in Colonial Dublon. Because of polygamy persecution, there was that community of polygamists there. And as she was a young girl, she ended up being George Romney's babysitter. Hmm. And then Pancho Villa came and drove a lot of the colonialists out, and she got on a train and ended up back in Utah with her mother. And her mother, my great-grandmother, had married like three brothers. Each one was killed, and as they, for reasons, passed away, she married the third brother. The third brother was a polygamist and had, in Utah, still had two families, one in Fairview and one on the other side of the mountain in Price. My grandmother, this experience was so vivid for her that she had certain attitudes about being persecuted, and she hated Mexicans, which is something that I just don't subscribe to. She hated polygamy because it reduced her life to poverty. And therefore, you know, it sort of passed down to my father and my aunt and my uncles. What I wonder is, what happened to George Romney during this period of time, and how did that shape his attitudes with his family?
That's a fascinating history. I mean, you understand
yes.
well then, you know, the harrowing journeys that were involved here, and the, you know, the emotional difficulty, of course, of being in these families when where there were multiple marriages and multiple families, and you know, and oftentimes, as we have in the book, I mean, you know, it was the wife's job to prepare a room to welcome another wife. I mean, really difficult stuff. That's hard to imagine. sort of in modern civilization. I wish I could give you more about, you know, sort of George's upbringing and how he was affected by all this. You know, you could write a whole book about George and, you know, in and of himself, and there certainly are those books out there. I'm not going to pretend to be a scholar about that, but you know, I think one thing is clear that we see in George and in Mid, and that is, I think, a sense that hard work is really, really important, and it's, you know, you sort of have nobody kind of but yourself to look out for you, and the how important self-reliance is and so forth. I mean, we see George, again, become this really successful auto executive by sheer force of will, really. He didn't have any, you know, educational pedigree to speak of. He didn't have connections. He had bounced around as a kid and didn't have a you know, traditional upbringing by any means. And through sheer hard work and pluck, you know, and some natural intuition and smart, he manages to lead one of the great American car companies and become an indelible figure in you know, post-war political history. I mean, one of the stories that I love about George is that he would play, you know, he would play a round of golf in the morning on, I think he would take like three balls and play each hole three times or something. So he'd play really quickly. And that's, there are little sort of glimpses of the kind of the Romney ethos. And we certainly see those in Mitt too. And I think Mitt is only, of course, built on his father's successes, both political and in business.
We need to talk about the private equity firm Bain Capital and how difficult it may have been for you and people at the Globe to get information about Bain Capital, the records that you looked at, the kinds of companies that were purchased, the jobs that were created or weren't created, the selling of companies. It seems to many of us to be a fairly complicated affair, and also how you can make a huge amount of money doing this.
It is, and this is one of the sort of unsatisfying, if you will, parts of the book, I think, because a lot of people want to know, well, okay, at the end of the day, is Bain a force for good or a force for ill?
Right.
And it's really hard, I think, to summarize not just Bain but other private equity firms, and you really have to look at what they did deal by deal. I mean, it's really what we conclude in the book is that it's almost impossible to really say, you know, here are the jobs that were created, here are the jobs that were lost, you know, and then figure out some kind of difference. I think what's clear is, you know, Bain Capital was extraordinarily successful at what they did. They were one of the premier private equity firms in the era, certainly in the 80s when they started and then into the 90s. They made spectacular returns for their investors. Mitt Romney and his colleagues got extremely rich. And the fact is there were deals where this meant going into a company, making it more efficient by cutting jobs and closing factories and putting people out of work and forcing efficiencies on places. But there were also occasions where they went in and applied their expertise and companies thrived and grew and continue to this day. So I think it's very hard to get a clear takeaway. I think what's one of the things, though, to keep in mind is that, you know, private equity, it's not about creating jobs. I mean, that's not the sole purpose. The sole purpose is they have a fiduciary responsibility to their investors to make as much money as they can.
Mm-hmm.
And what a lot of people don't realize is that those investors, yes, there are people like Mitt Romney and his wealthy friends and so forth, but there are also a lot of public pension funds and university endowments and you know, union pension funds. I would not be surprised at all if some of the endowment money at UW-Madison, my proud alma mater, were not invested somewhere with private equity. And that's because the returns have been generally very good and stronger than you can get in other kinds of investments. So, you know, Mitt Romney talked about this today and says, you know, I know how jobs come and go. Therefore, I, you know, I'm the one with the expertise to turn around this economy. And I think there's some undeniable truth to that. He definitely has some economic fluency and economic expertise, regardless of, you know, how you feel about his politics. But it is true that there are a lot of really difficult stories out there, and a lot of occasions where Bain, you know, loaded up companies with debt and the partners made out really well and other people didn't make out so well. So this is what Mitt Romney calls, you know, creative destruction. This is the nature of capitalism.
Mm-hmm. And,
you know, he stands by it very, very much.
Mm. It's one thing I don't understand when you hear about these the tax rates and where money is being put in offshore accounts, money being put in Switzerland. If you were this interested in a political life, and he's already run for president before, why would you do something like that? Well, you've already got so much money. Why wouldn't you just put your money in America?
It is perplexing, and you're right, because so much of what Mitt Romney has done in his life has been to prepare for running for office. I mean, he is somebody who I think for decades, ever since watching his father, knew that he would want to follow that example at some point. And in fact, one of his good friends told me a story about how in the 1970s, I think it was, late 70s, so Mitt Romney at this point is barely 30 years old, they were approached to do some sort of real estate investment early on, and there was nothing illegal about it, this friend said, but it was kind of shady, you know, didn't smell totally right. And Mitt Romney said, you know what, I don't want to do this, because if I ever run for office someday, you know, this isn't something I want people to know about.
Mm.
Now, why didn't he extend the same caution to his own finances? You know, why the offshore
right.
accounts? Why the Swiss bank accounts? It's a good question, and you know, we see him, I think, still, I mean, he's still getting hammered for it, you know, day after day. I mean, even just yesterday, President Obama
in his press conference, yeah.
In his press conference in the White House is saying, you know, okay, there might be nothing illegal there, but I bet if you ask most Americans if they stuff money in Swiss bank accounts, most people are going to say,
what?
No.
Right.
You know, right. I didn't even know you could do that.
Right.
And again, maybe this gets to the tenure thing we were talking about earlier, that he just doesn't. There's something that he doesn't grasp about how most people view money and finances and taxes and the situation that the vast majority of Americans find themselves in. And it's just, he is not in that class of people. You know, he is in a class of people for whom several hundred thousand dollars in speaking fees is, in his words, not very much money. You know?
Yeah. Marcia, thanks so much for your very interesting call. Mike in South Milwaukee. Hi.
Hello. I'm hearing sort of a sympathetic take on Mitt Romney, and one thing that bothers me, and I don't think it's been addressed, is he can couch in various terms that the guy is fundamentally awkward, very socially awkward, as evidenced by his trip to London, the comments he made about the Olympics. He went to Israel, he made comments about the Palestinians. In high school at Cranbrook, he cut off a probably gay kid's hair. He ran around in a state trooper's uniform in Michigan. He has some bizarre awkwardness, and he has demonstrated bizarre behavior. This isn't just reserved. He hides his Swiss bank account. There's something fundamentally wrong with this guy. Comments?
All right, let's get a response. We're running short on time.
Scott. Sure. I mean, I don't think there's any question. I think we did talk about that earlier. There's he's incredibly awkward at times. I mean, just one quick example, and I could tell many of these, but I was up in New Hampshire with him in last fall, and he's talking to this group of, you know, sympathetic people, and he's talking about how great technology is, and he pulls out his phone, I think, and he's talking about, you know, he says, I can take a blooming picture with my phone, you know, isn't that amazing? And then he says, it's the bane of my campaign, by the way, that everybody has a camera. And everybody laughs, because you think what he's going to say is, it's really hard to be a candidate. You're never off. You can always have these moments recorded, right? Which we could all sympathize with.
Right.
But no, what does he say? He says, yeah, you know, you go to these events and everybody afterward wants a picture of you with them. And the room goes silent. And it's clear at this moment that every one of these people is hoping to get a picture of him with them afterward, right? And he's just insulted the entire room. And it's like his mouth is a couple of seconds ahead of his brain. And you see him try to switch gears and correct himself. But, I mean, these stories are legion, and it's never something that he's been good at.
One more phone call. Elizabeth in Richland Center. I'll have to be short. Hi.
And it's like his mouth is a couple of seconds out of his brain. And
hello, Elizabeth.
Switch gears and
correct. Well, Elizabeth has got the radio on, and that's too bad. Thanks very much for all of your calls, everybody. We can take an email back to Vietnam here. Crystal Lake, Illinois. Dave says, Romney pulled a move tantamount to Clinton's use of political connections in avoiding service. He used his 4D deferment as an excuse not to risk his life in a war he had no problem letting others risk their lives in.
Yeah, I mean, that's, again, there was a tremendous controversy at the time about whether it was fair to let all these young Mormon men off the hook, if you will. But that, I mean, you guys certainly, you can make that argument, I think, against Mitt Romney, but it's also one you could make against, you know, the wealthy and the elite and the connected and so forth across the country. And
right.
This is something that continues to this day, this debate about the sort of classist, you know, view of the military and who serves and who doesn't.
It's true that his family never argues. He and his, I can't imagine a marriage like that. They don't argue?
Well, I think what, I mean, certainly they have disagreements and so forth. But, you know, in Mormon life, you know, family is everything. And
right.
The Mormon matriarch is a really important figure to hold the family together. It's a, you know, it's a very traditional view in many ways. And I think in that way, Mitt Romney sees Ann as a central part of his life, you know, as a partner and counselor and all those other things. But more than that, almost somebody who presides over the most important thing for a prominent Mormon, a practicing Mormon. So I think
thank you, Scott.
That's
we're out of time. It's a fascinating book. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Scott Hellman, the book is The Real Romney, just been published in paperback and very interesting. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers for producing this hour.